Greetings, friends. Welcome to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast where we review films. Oh no!
Run!
Hooray for sound effects. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic. That's all, just a film critic. With me, as always, is another film critic. Introduce yourself, other film critic.
I am other film critic. My name is Bibbs. Everyone calls me William Bibbiani.
Your parents thought ahead then.
Yeah, they were good.
If your name is other film critic.
Yep, that's a name they thought I'd grow into. My name is William Bibbiani. Everybody calls me Bibbs. And it's Critically Acclaimed. We review new movies here in Critically Acclaimed. This week, we're reviewing a bunch of them. We're reviewing A Quiet Place Part 2. An even quieter place, no doubt.
Quieter. Even more quietly.
We're reviewing the new Disney film Cruella. We're reviewing something called Swimming Out Till the Sea Turns Blue, which I believe is what happened at the end of the movie Gattaca.
It's a documentary film. I'll be talking about that one.
It's a documentary film about the ending of Gattaca.
It's not about Gattaca. It's about Chinese literature.
That's very different. We're reviewing the new horror movie Skull, The Mask. We're reviewing the new film Plan B on Hulu. And reviewing the new doc about Moby called Moby Doc.
Isn't that clever?
Yeah.
Isn't that cute?
So on the nose. And
It seems like it should lose points, you know.
We'll talk about how that movie loses points when we get to it. One thing we're not doing this week on Critically Acclaimed is having a streaming club. And that is not because something happened and we had to delay the movie streaming club, where we review movies that are also on streaming services but are older. We're actually moving that to its own podcast. We feel like it's time. Every time we have a Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club segment, ended up being at least around as long as all the movie reviews that preceded it. So we figured, what the hell? Let's give the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club its own podcast, and it will be its own thing starting this week. So stick around. It should be up tomorrow. We're going to be doing, because the last poll on our Patreon page was a tie, we let our patrons decide what we review on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club. We're going to be kicking it off with a double feature of a gnome named Gnorm, one of only two films directed by VFX maestro Stan Winston. It's about a gnome. His name is Gnorm, and he teams up with a cop to stop bad guys.
It's a cop movie with a gnome.
Not a gnome.
And that's the correct pronunciation.
According to the film, they
correct you in the course of the film.
Yeah, we're also going to be reviewing Troop Beverly Hills, starring Shelley Long and everyone.
There's a lot
of cameos in that movie. So that's going to be coming up. All of those films. So that's going to be on the streaming club, and that will be released tomorrow. But today we talk about the new stuff.
What would you like to talk about first, William?
Well, we typically start with, like, the biggest release.
Right, well,
and I think most people would have assumed that would have been Disney's Cruella. But at the box office, it was A Quiet Place Part 2. Now,
that's right.
I suspect that probably has a lot to do with Disney's whole thing of, if you want to pay extra, like it's like $30 or something.
$30, and you can get it immediately on their streaming service.
Disney Plus. And on one hand, if you're like one person, maybe two, buying a ticket, that doesn't seem like a good deal. If you're a whole family, that's a great deal.
Yeah. So
that's saving you like seriously, at least 20, 40 bucks on tickets, another 20, 40 bucks on snacks, parking, not an issue. So yeah, I'm very curious what the streaming numbers are to see if Cruella just wasn't that interesting to people, or if it did blockbuster numbers on Disney Plus and theatrically just okay.
Well, because Netflix set the precedent of streaming services never having to release their numbers, we'll never know that.
They'll tell us if they're amazing, basically, and that's it.
Yeah. How successful the film is doesn't matter to me.
Not really.
It shouldn't matter to anyone, really, unless you're an investor. But Cruella is not grabbing the headlines, and it's not setting box office records. Neither is A Quiet Place Part 2. But it's making impressive enough numbers that people are talking about it.
So
why don't we talk about that one because of box office receipts?
Okay. Now, I didn't get to see A Quiet Place Part 2. I did like the first A Quiet Place quite a bit. It's a film directed by John Krasinski, and it stars John Krasinski, Emily Blunt, and Millicent Simmons.
Millicent Simmons is her name, and she's sort of the star this time around.
Yeah,
A Quiet Place. The end of the first A Quiet Place found,
which was about a near future in which like aliens.
Yeah, it's a post-apocalyptic movie.
Yeah.
Space aliens have invaded. They're blind. They can only hear you, and they have very sensitive hearing because their entire head is like an ear with teeth. And they also attack and murder anything that they hear.
Yeah, they must find noise really annoying. They're like Grendel and Beowulf. So basically, if you have to be incredibly quiet all the time, or else they'll just immediately show up and kill you.
Yeah,
which is, you know, it's a bit of a flawed premise, but it's a great premise for a movie. It's really fun. Yeah. It leads to a lot of suspense.
Thin premise, one that you'll be thinking about the holes in while you're watching the movie rather than after.
Yeah. Like, there's a bit in the original movie where, in order to finally, like, be able to talk to his child, John Krasinski takes his child to a waterfall, which the aliens would naturally avoid because it's constantly noisy and there's nothing they can do about it. And so he talks to his kid there, and which raises the question, why don't you always live there?
Just set up home near a waterfall.
Yeah, wouldn't that solve a lot of your problems? And the answer to that question is yes.
And instead, they live in the first movie, they live on this sort of repurposed farm, which has been completely tricked out with, like, alien sensing measures, like alien precautionary measures. So there's alerts and lights that go on. They've laid sand down, like, for miles and miles so that their footfalls don't make any noise in the woods. It seems to me like the effort it would take to set all that stuff up might make some noise and attract some attention. It would also take like a decade rather than like a month, which is probably how long it took. The opening of A Quiet Place Part 2, we get to see the first sighting of the aliens in flashback. Cool. So John Krasinski is back.
Do we confirm that they're aliens? Or is that still a mystery?
They fall from the sky.
Okay.
They are aliens.
Aliens. Good, because they were kind of vague about it in the first
they're
one.
They're not
just
like
monsters.
Yeah, mutants out of the Umbrella Corporation or anything. Right, they're
aliens
from outer space. Space aliens from outer space.
Okay.
And
I wish that would have been the name of the movie. Space aliens from outer space. Yeah.
John Krasinski is directing again, and he's really doing a lot of really creative things with the camera and with sound this time around. Like, he's really experimenting in some pretty exciting ways, I would say. He sort of zooms in and out of what people are hearing in any given moment. So there's a lot of cool things with the sound mixing that Millicent Simmons, she's a deaf actress playing a deaf character. She can't hear, like, but the slightest sound, so we get to hear things from her perspective occasionally, which changes, you know, sort of the dynamic of what the tension is, who can hear what, and who's in immediate danger. After the intro, where we get to see the invasion, we get to cut back to the end of the first movie, where Emily Blunt and the kids and a new baby are now trying to find a new home because their last one has been wrecked by aliens, as it was in the climax of the last movie.
Yeah.
They end up falling into the company of Cillian Murphy, because he's played by Cillian Murphy. You don't know if he's a villain or not. With Cillian Murphy, it could go either way, actually.
Yeah, he's been great heroes 28 Days Later, he's also been great villains, Batman, and everything in between. He's a really versatile actor. I really like him a lot.
Yeah, he's really, really great. And it's pretty clear that he's not going to be the new AirSat's father figure, even though he kind of fulfills that role. In fact, it's now up to Millicent Simmons, the young daughter, who is maybe 13 or so, to essentially take up the mantle of central protector. They found out a special trick where they can actually, like, force the alien heads open and then shoot them with a shotgun. Well, that's another detail about the aliens. They're bulletproof.
Yeah.
You can't just shoot them or blow them up. They're, like, nearly indestructible. So, in the climax of the last movie, they figured out a way to blow up their heads.
Yeah.
And now it's up to Millicent Simmons to find a radio tower so they can essentially Mars Attacks them and set up, you know, the Slim Whitman music and make all their heads explode.
I'll be calling you.
Yep. It's not actually Slim Whitman. That's the movie Mars Attacks. But it's something comparable. And the movie is essentially just a quest to get there. I'm not really sure what John Krasinski is trying to do or say other than just sort of play around with a fun monster movie premise. And he does it well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun. And that's kind of all you can really say. It's okay. It's fun. It's fun to watch. Hey! You like Monster Mayhem? Good. There's some fun camera stuff that John Krasinski is doing. Great.
I remember when the...
Millicent Simmons is the hero of this movie. She is a great actress, and I hope that she gets more and more roles. I've only seen her in three movies, Quiet Place 1 and 2, and a wonderful film called Wonderstruck, which... is about how great it is to have libraries around. Really wonderful movie.
It's a great theme.
Yeah, she's just really forceful and confident and has a lot of screen presence, and I really hope she can get a lot more work. Just have an incidentally deaf lead. It's fine.
Yeah, please.
it was great to see her. There's some great cameos near the end of the movie where, of course, there's like islands where people are hanging out and all. Yeah. A lot of cult of cannibals. There's, you know, all the usual tropes we see in a lot of post-apocalyptic movies. Mm. This kind of movie
really helps
is...
to be quiet cannibalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, oh, I'm sorry.
Yum, 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 yum. You're monsters. I know. Yeah. The fun of this kind of movie is the mechanic.
Yeah, that's just the thing that I was always noticing about the first one, where it kind of just... Honestly, because I remember when the first Quiet Place came out, and it's a good movie, but it's a gimmick movie. You know, it's a fun premise, and it forces the filmmaker to deal with that premise in a very Hitchcockian rope sort of way. Yeah. Or Lifeboat, maybe, might be a more accurate example. Can I make a whole movie on a lifeboat? Can I make a whole movie where any noise would result in the end of the film?
Yeah.
So, I remember he was struggling. I heard people, like, John Krasinski was talking about, like, yeah, well, it's really about how, you know, we're forcing people to stay silent instead of talking about, like, no, there's no fucking theme to your movie at all.
It's just about how do you... What are the rules and how do you traverse them?
I think the weirdest...
He comes up with a few interesting new scenarios, but... It's just scenario.
What I remember being very impressed by, though, and I feel like this is all... this was his point, he would have articulated it. But I think what was kind of cool about it, and to me what the point of A Quiet Place ultimately is it trains audiences to stop talking in movies. I remember watching A Quiet Place on opening night in a theater, and it wasn't a full theater, but it was a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's that usual hum... of people talking, like, during the trailers and stuff. Like, oh, we should see that, or that looks like crap. Or, oh, the John find his seat? That kind of just usual talking, whatever. Mm. And then as the movie started and they realized that this is not going to be a loud movie. Mm. And people are not talking. And there's not a lot of music even. And people started just gradually but quickly shut up. Mm. And then... After like 5 minutes, you heard like someone crinkle their candy and everything else went shh. And it just like forced the audience to appreciate silence. And I think that was kind of cool in a meta way, but that's about as far as I'm willing to go.
Well, I wish it had gone even further, because there's a lot of thriller kind of music. There's, you know, a big score. There's going to be moments where they're in a bunker and they actually get to have conversations. How great if they had just had an all silent movie where there's no dialogue. It's all just action, and everybody is as quiet as possible, and they try to tell the story with just silent soundscapes.
Yeah.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
No such luck. The monsters are kind of cool looking, I guess.
They
got big, long, spindly arms, which look really cool.
Yeah.
There's a trend in monster sound effects that I'm growing incredibly tired of, and it's the way they make monsters roar or growl in movies. Mm. There's a sort of kind of guttural noise that I hear in every monster movie now. That kind of noise.
You still do that predator noise off the top of my head.
It's so common that it's no longer scary or threatening. It's like, oh no, there you can hear the noises. Like, yeah, that's a movie sound effect out of... It's like the Hanna-Barbera drawer now. Just throw it away. You don't get to use those sound effects anymore.
Yeah.
So they're not entirely threatening, these monsters. Especially now that we know how to kill them.
Well, the thing always bugged me about, like, I appreciated everything building up to the ending of A Quiet Place. And then the ending, I thought, was actually kind of frustrating. Like, oh, what's the trick to killing these monsters that are, like, that have really sensitive hearing? Loud noises? Yeah, no one ever occurred. It never occurred to anyone to do that. Really? No one? No one tried throwing a grenade at him or something? Like, nobody? Really?
It's not just loud noises. It's a specific noise that comes from, like, a specialized device.
But it's like a dog whistle, though. Like, that's the idea, though.
It was her hearing aid.
I appreciate that, but it's still a frequency. And it just feels like if their whole thing with these aliens is their hearing... I mean, maybe the aliens, like, killed all the noisy scientists first. Like, all the radio enthusiasts were just killed off immediately.
And these are clearly, like, animals. They're not, like, intelligent beings. Or if they are, they don't display intelligence. They just sort of chase and murder people.
Maybe they're, like, Gargans. You know what I'm talking about in the movie
Teenagers from Outer Space.
Teenagers from Outer Space is about a bunch of really old looking teenagers from outer space who come to Earth, and the idea is they're looking for a planet on which to raise a herd of gigantic monsters that they use for food. So it's basically like looking for them, like, oh, this will be a great grazing ground for our monsters, Earth. And their monsters are Gargans, and Gargans are lobsters. They're big fucking lobsters.
To their credit, they're lobsters superimposed over the action of the shot. So it looks like they're giant.
So it looks like they're kind of big.
Actually, it doesn't look like they're giant. It looks like somebody superimposed a lobster over the shot of
a
movie.
It looks really bad. Oh, man. The bowl of crayfish spilled over here. What happened? But, like, wouldn't it be funny if it turned out that the aliens from A Quiet Place were just Gargans? It was just
that'd,
like,
be great.
Like, that's we just threw them onto your planet. We don't care what they kill. We just we'll come back, have some Gargan burgers, and we're good to go.
Unfortunately, there's no expansion of what they are or what they do or where they came from.
Well, that's what A Quiet Place Part 3 is for.
I mean, if this one is making as much bank, then yeah, sure, we can cynically say yes, we can expect a sequel. But
I want
more in the story. That would have been nice. It would be about something.
Well, there should be like a Mockbuster called A Loud Place. Everything's really loud.
If you don't stop screaming, then the aliens attack. That's AKA Twitter. Yeah, thank you.
Well played. Well played indeed. All right, is there anything else left to say about A Quiet Place?
This was my first film back in a theater since February of 2020, so that was
it a mind-blowing experience?
No, it was exactly the same. This may be an odd comment, but, like, I wasn't gone so long that I missed it, like, that I'd forgotten about parts of the film-going experience.
Yeah. Well, it helps that we go to movie theaters constantly.
Constantly. The scent of the AMC in Century City has not changed one whit. That sort of...
That's a little disappointing, actually. You would think popcorn, you would have taken the opportunity to
like
clean
steam
it up
the carpets
a
or something. Yeah, that sort of, like... popcorn / garbage smell that you get in movie theaters.
Just a hint of Pine Sol, so you know they tried.
They tried a little bit. The Coke syrup that's been stomped into the ground and will never go away, even as thousands of years pass.
Yeah.
I worked in a movie theater. The scent of that polyester vest will never leave me. It's sort of permeating the air in the movie theater. It's still... too damn many previews before the movie. It's like 30-minute pre-show.
Well, it's AMC, of course it is.
Yeah. And this part was really sad. It says, thanks for coming back to the movies. We're celebrating our 100th year last year in 2020.
Oh,
like they show
no.
this thing as like, yes, 1920 to 2020. 100 years. Damn it.
Can we get a mulligan on that? We all get a mulligan on 2020.
Okay, 101. It's 101 now.
That's 101's still cool. Ooh, that's a good segue. From 101 years to 101 Dalmatians, the prequel. So it's two. It's like two Dalmatians.
There's three Dalmatians.
Oh, there are three Dalmatians. I apologize. There are three. And we don't find out what happened to the third one. the fate of... There are three Dalmatians in this movie.
They got
the fate of one of them is unclear. okay, so 101 Dalmatians is weirdly... And I don't mean this in a bad way. It's just if you would ask me, like, if you adjust for inflation, like, what's the most, like, successful Disney movie? Like, 101 Dalmatians is, I think, at least in, like, the top two. Like, it's incredibly
like that,
financially
that
successful.
And, like, The Lion King.
Like, no. Like, hold on. If you adjust for inflation, I think it's that and Snow White.
Oh, that makes more sense.
Hold on a second.
Okay, but 101 Dalmatians was a huge hit. I saw 101 Dalmatians for the first time this year.
This year?
Yeah, I had not watched 101 Dalmatians. Mm. It is an incredibly slight movie. Mm. I'm kind of surprised that it's considered like sort of one of the bigger ones because it feels very lesser to me.
I'm looking at the adjusted for inflation box office grosses. The top 10 adjusted for inflation. Now, what adjusted for inflation means, if we don't know what we're talking about, ticket prices have not stayed the same. Boy, do I wish they had. That would be great. Yeah, can you imagine seeing two movies for a nickel? It would be great.
They take the grosses of a film made in 1961 and adjust the cost of a dollar in 1961 to what it is.
Basically, the idea is what we're looking at isn't necessarily how much they made, but how many tickets were sold. That's what it boils down to. So if tickets cost as much today as they did when, say, the Ten Commandments came out, then domestically, only domestically, international records are a little spottier the further back you go. Only domestically, the Ten Commandments made almost $1.2 billion domestically. That's how many people saw it. So when you think about like how popular Star Wars or Avatar were, like only in domestically, Ten Commandments. The top 10 highest grossing movies of all time, adjusted for inflation, again, domestically, United States. Number one, I'm sorry about this, Gone with the Wind. Number two, Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. Number three, The Sound of Music. Not Marvel, none, Sound of Music, number three. Number four, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Number five, James Cameron's Titanic. Number six, The Ten Commandments. Number seven, Jaws.
Okay.
Someone once asked me, like, oh, well, name a horror movie that ever made more than $1 billion. Jaws. If you adjust for inflation and you actually look at, like, what counts. Number eight, here's a film that no one talks about anymore as a giant blockbuster, but it was Dr. Zhivago.
That's right.
Made over $1 billion if you adjust for inflation.
Big, big sweeping romances were big business.
The last film that, if you adjust for inflation, would have grossed over $1 billion domestically. Number nine, The Exorcist.
Hey.
Number 10, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Number 11, Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. And number 12, 101 Dalmatians, the original animated version. That is ahead of The Empire Strikes Back. That is ahead of Ben-Hur. That is ahead of Avatar and Avengers Endgame. That's ahead of Jurassic Park. Holy shit, that was a popular movie. Now, granted, we're talking about re-releases too,
I was about to say, Disney was really good about re-releasing their films. Come see the Disney magic again, and that adds to the grosses as well.
But it still shows a lot of interest and a lot of popularity.
And a lot of this, there are also extenuating circumstances. Maybe this was one that they had more widely available. Maybe it struck more prints for whatever reason.
Whatever
the reason, 101 Dalmatians is one of the highest grossing films of all time. And like I said, I don't quite understand that, because like Snow White is kind of a big movie. This gigantic animated feature before the animated features were super common.
It's not the first. Don't believe Disney's lies. It was like the first like really big prominent one that got that huge.
It got a special Academy Award and seven small Academy Awards.
That's really cool. Yeah, actually.
Look up the pictures. They made like little mini Oscars.
The Oscars don't do that anymore. It's a shame.
I wonder where those are. They're probably in a Disney vault somewhere. Yeah. 101 Dalmatians came out in 1961, and it's a movie about dogs watching television. It's about a songwriter whose dog feels that he's not getting he's too much of a bachelor, and he needs a girlfriend / wife. So the dog named Pongo in voiceover, first in voiceover, and then he actually speaks to other dogs. Takes him out on a walk. He meets a lady in the park. She also has a Dalmatian. And
her name is Perdita.
Perdita is the Dalmatian. Anita is the human woman. And they move in together. And
everything's great.
Pongo and Perdita have a litter of puppies. And there's a big dramatic scene where she's giving birth to puppies.
She doesn't give birth to 101. But she gives birth to like, what, 20 or something?
It's like 15, I think.
It's like a lot. It is a lot.
She gives birth to a large litter of puppies. Big dramatic moment. One looks like it's dead, but it's not.
They stole that from Batteries Not Included.
a movie that was made 25 years later, of course.
They're very clever.
And then there's a huge long segment of the movie where the dogs just watch TV.
They're just chilling out.
Wow, look, there's TV, and it's like a Rin Tin Tin type show. Yeah. It's a dog show. Yeah. Early in the movie, they got a visit from a character named Cruella De Vil, who loves furs and smokes cigarettes and is a little bit overbearing. And she's so overbearing that Roger writes a song about her.
About how much she's an awful human being.
It's not as good a diss track as "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch," but it's a good one.
Yeah, but what always bothered me about that scene is that we know in the audience, because at least we've seen the trailer, that Cruella De Vil is going to kidnap those puppies and try to turn them into clothes. They don't know that. They just know that she's, like, a friend of Anita who, like, smokes too much, which is to say it all, but you know what I mean, who, like, smokes annoyingly, grotesquely a lot. And
the color of cigarette smoke green in the movie, so it's like his pipe and his cigar, or his cigarettes don't...
Because Roger smokes
as well.
Oh, then
but
fuck
he smokes gray smoke, yeah, and so Cruella's smoke is green.
Yeah, gray smoke is healthy, says Disney.
Walt Disney smoked like a chimney, by the way.
That's and he died. Cruella De Vil is overbearing, and that's it. So basically, he writes a hate song about the only friend we know for a fact his wife has. That's the only friend we know she has. And it's also, near as we can tell, they're the only friends Cruella De Vil has. And they write horrible hate music about her. And a part of me is a little bit on Cruella De Vil's side right at the beginning, because, yeah, she's been through terrible things. But clearly she doesn't have, like, a social safety net or anything, and people, like, looking out for her. I feel bad for her.
Yeah. Cruella De Vil she's into fur, which was very common in the 1960s.
For a long time,
actually. I mean, there have always been people who protested wearing fur, but fur was actually a very common and widespread status symbol in the United States throughout
I think it was the 80s, people started to fall out of fashion, right?
Yeah, like starting from maybe around the 1920s until, around the 80s when people started saying... It just sort of, stop being a thing. Or people were getting faux fur, and that was more acceptable.
Yeah.
But the idea of actually having, like, a mink coat was a status symbol. So she's obsessed with that status. She wants fur. She wants dog fur, spotted dog fur. So she's going to kidnap Anita's puppies and skin them and make them into a coat. But evidently she needs a whole lot of them. I don't know how big a coat she's going to make. But she needs a lot of really soft puppy fur, so she has a house, like this dilapidated mansion full of puppies she's kidnapped.
Yeah, not just the hero puppies that we know, but like it's 101 of them.
Also a bunch of other ones. Who knows? I don't know where they came from, but she just has them. And there's 101 in all, hence the title. And the movie is, from then on, is about how Pongo and Perdita have to enlist essentially the dog police. Where are you coming from, dog police? Nobody knows where you are.
Are you excited for the Paw Patrol movie? It's coming out this year.
You know, my son's over Paw Patrol.
Really? That's good.
He's, he's six already, and that's like just out of the range of Paw Patrol.
Dad, I'm growing up now. I'm not watching Paw Patrol.
But you know what? We just replaced his Paw Patrol sheets today.
Oh,
it's like a rite of passage. Oh, he outgrew the Paw Patrol sheets.
What's he moved on
to? Super Mario now. He has Super Mario sheets.
Right. Super Mario will always be popular.
Yeah, Super Mario, I feel, I mean, nowadays adults buy Super Mario sheets.
Yeah. Chubby, heroic Italian guys. Like, it's not, there are a lot of us, but I'm glad that one of them is, like, just a permanent part of the public consciousness.
Just a heroic hero who defeats dragons. He's just a chubby little dude.
Yeah, love him.
Then there's a whole rescue, and there's this long, prolonged sequence where they're just the dogs are trudging through the snow away from Cruella De Vil's mansion so they don't get skinned.
It's like hard. Like, it's a chase movie, basically, once it gets going. Yeah.
They disguise themselves in ashes, they get home, and that's kind of it. Cruella De Vil crashes her car, and that's the last we see of her.
Yeah.
Over the years, the myth of Cruella De Vil seems to have grown to the point where she was featured in some live-action remakes of 101 Dalmatians in 96 and I think 98 or 99.
Yeah, I want to say it was like 2000 or something, but it was played, she was played by Glenn Close. And if you haven't seen those live-action movies, the movies themselves are okay. Like, they're okay. Glenn Close is amazing. Like, I remember when 101 Dalmatians came out, the live-action remake, there was legit Oscar buzz around Glenn Close. People were actually saying she deserves an Academy Award nomination for being so otherworldly good as Cruella De Vil. And I rewatched them not that long ago, like a couple of years ago. Yeah, she's great. Yeah. Those are fun films. But, especially the first one. Those are fun.
But the myth has only grown since then.
Yeah.
To the point where Cruella DeVille, like her Cruella DeVille had a daughter in that show or movie, whatever it was, The Descendants.
I think it was a show. Yeah.
Which posits a world where all of Disney features coexist.
Yeah.
And all of the villains are about the same age and had children around the same time, and now they all are going to the same high school together.
There was also a version of Cruella in that show, I think it was called Once Upon a Time.
Oh,
there was, that
yeah,
was also
yeah.
another one so, where all the Disney versions yeah. of those
so
things were real.
This overbearing character who smokes too much and wants to make a puppy coat is now like this villain for the ages, the point where now she's been swept up in this big Disney remake machine that has been really in vogue for the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, I think Cruella DeVille, and I actually like Cruella DeVille as a character fine, especially as a villain, because the thing with Disney is that they didn't have a lot of really forceful female characters for a while there. And so a character like Maleficent or Cruella DeVille.
There's like evil queens and...
Evil
and,
queens.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of them were villains, is my point. A lot of them were trained as villains. And a lot and a lot of the heroic women were, you know, maybe a little less...
Wilting flowers, probably.
Well, I don't know about wilting flowers, but, you know, Alice in Wonderland is really that proactive a protagonist. Cinderella is, you know, not the kind of heroine I think a lot of people would want to see now. Characters like Maleficent and Cruella they're go-getters, aren't they? They're entrepreneurs. They have strong opinions about things. They have audacious fashion choices. They're standout characters, I think. And I think that's why they linger and endure, even though they're evil, they're cool, you know, and I think it's a sad state of affairs when, for too long, women in these types of stories had two options: you could either be a damsel in distress or the villain.
Yeah, yeah.
And so who wouldn't pick the villain in that scenario? So I think she has an allure. Is my point?
Okay, I get it. I get the allure. I just don't get sort of the inflation of her. Oh, but there's a lot I don't understand about the way popular culture functions. Why are you listening to me?
Because you're an outsider opinion, and that makes it interesting.
I suppose so.
There's an old gag from Taxi where Andy Kaufman had a line, what's your opinion of the human race? I want an outsider's take.
Love it.
Yeah.
Cruella DeVille is now getting... more or less the Joker treatment. We get to see her origins, how she came to be so villainous. And this film, directed by Craig Gillespie, takes place largely in London in the 1970s, although we do get to see Cruella DeVille as a young girl, as she's being raised by a single mother, how she had difficult times in school, and...
She was born with her white and black hair, which
she has half white, half black hair, just sort of as naturally grew. And we get to see a rather tragic incident in her childhood when her mom was going to ask a rich person for a little bit of a handout to help her raise Cruella, who was having trouble in school. And due to a twist of fate, a pack of Dalmatians chased her mother off of a cliff and killed her.
I'm sorry.
Really stupid.
I'm sorry. This scene has been making the rounds on Twitter, just the sort of in a vacuum this moment. And there's two types of reactions to it that I've seen. One is, that's ridiculous. The other one is, well, you have to watch the whole thing in context. I've seen the whole thing in context. It's ridiculous.
It's still ridiculous.
It's very, very clear that this scene did not evolve organically out of a screenplay. This scene exists in order to justify something we never needed to justify.
All of these things, this is clearly a film made by people who have watched 101 Dalmatians a lot and have memorized the details. I feel the way about the Han Solo movie.
Yeah.
It's like all these little tiny details that you'll only notice if you watch Star Wars 100 times are now very significant parts of the Han Solo story.
Yeah.
Like how he got his gun. He has like a pair of dice hanging from his mirror. It's like we get to know where those things
they
came.
Only
like we don't care.
They only made These that are, a thing yeah. in the new prequel, in the new movies anyway. That wasn't even in the original movies.
Yeah,
they made that up so that they could retroactively put it in Han Solo as if it meant something.
So all of these little tiny details are now given setup in this unbelievably long film about the rise of Cruella DeVille. Now, there is a fun bit of story here where Cruella De Vil she's always been interested in fashion, and she aspires to become fashion designer. So she takes a job with the Baroness, played by the wonderful Emma Thompson. Cruella De Vil as an adult is played by Emma Stone. And she feels that this is sort of like her ticket to stardom. She gets to work for this high-end fashion designer. How she comes to work for the fashion designer is a whole thing.
That plot point ripped off from the movie Mannequin.
It definitely was.
Yeah, they clearly saw the movie. I'm not complaining, but let's be fair here. Someone in who's made that movie loves the movie Mannequin. Good for them.
There's also a pair of like criminal thugs in 101 Dalmatians. It turns out they were like her
childhood roommates.
They were like Oliver Twist thieving buddies. Like they lived in an attic and they stole stuff boxes and hankies. So there's also a bit of story introducing them and their growing up and everything they do together. How she befriended the local thrift shop owner. All of these things are just sort of padding things out to get to the actual story, which is actually a very brief part of this movie.
This very long movie.
Yeah.
I was watching this movie and I thought everything was wrapping up, and I checked out just to see how much longer it was. An hour. I'm like, what's left? And the answer is a lot of padding. A lot of this movie is music. And that's not a bad thing per se, obviously. But so much of this movie is attempting to be told through a soundtrack that they sometimes just let scenes run forever just to get more of the soundtrack in. And it's wall to wall. Now, I'll say this about the soundtrack. A lot of little kids who don't know anything about 70s rock are going to get some good tunes on the soundtrack, and they're going to want to buy the soundtrack and listen to the soundtrack. That's good.
Introduced to these things for the first time.
In a vacuum, that's good. Problem is, it's all punk rock stuff, and this is the least punk rock movie ever.
Well, it's punk rock, it's new wave, it's stuff that was like really hip in 70s London, ostensibly.
But like that was like a rebellious sort of anti-establishment sound. Yeah. And this movie is incredibly establishment. Even Cruella herself, even though she ends up in this sort of rivalry that escalates and escalates and escalates with the Baroness, what does she want? Mainstream popularity and financial success. That's what she wants.
That's the theme of the movie. It's also put out by Disney. And when Disney is putting The Clash's Should I Stay or Should I Go under their soundtrack, trying to get some like punk cred, that's like a dad saying, I'm cool too, kids. Here's what real music sounds like. It's grasping for punk cred, but it is brazenly and cynically commercial in its construct and in its themes.
I know. Well, and what's weird is that sometimes they just get the song completely wrong. Like, one thing that really pissed me off was the introduction where we first see, for the first time in all of her glory, Emma Thompson, who was really good in this movie. She's good in everything.
She comes into the Doors.
She comes into the Doors song 5-1. It's got a pumping, like, theme to it. It sounds like a good villain song. And it's like, it introduces like her theme. The song 5-1 is about how the young now outnumber the old 5-1, and they're going to take over. So this should be Cruella's song, not the Baroness's song. It's the exact opposite here. And not that that's like a killer or anything like that, like that ruins the movie, but to me that's very emblematic of just how little thought went into this other than this sounds cool on a soundtrack.
Yeah.
And how we're taking all of these punk aesthetics, whether it's the music or the fashion design or really any artistic element of this movie that harkens back to that, and we're just superficially ladling it onto this as a way to sell you things rather than any respect. And this is a movie about art. This is a movie about two artists fighting for supremacy. One artist who's been doing it for forever and is very formal, and another artist who is trying to do something bold and exciting and new, and yet it feels so thin and superficial. It's so crap.
If you're being very generous, make the same argument about Cruella that you could about The Neon Demon, which is another film about fashion. And fashion and modeling and the modeling world.
Great double feature.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not a fan of Cruella, but that'd be a cool double feature.
And I am a fan of the Neon Demon, and I think it's not for reasons that Nicholas Winding Refn wants me to be.
Agreed.
Because that is a film about how hollow the fashion industry is, man. It's all just empty spectacle, and it's supposed to be really kind of a condemnation when it itself is empty spectacle.
Yeah.
Which actually helps the theme in a way that I think the film didn't intend.
Yeah. No, it's actually kind of perfect. And it's completely clueless about itself, and I love that.
There's none of that serendipitous cluelessness about Cruella. Everything feels orchestrated in Cruella.
It's completely contrived. Yeah. Everything from the dogs killing Cruella's mom to really just the entire plot is just all about Eve with a little Devil Wears Prada and a little mannequin. I'm like, boom, you got it. And right at the end, a little Thomas Crown Affair remake, which I thought was really random and didn't end up going anywhere.
And when we finally get to the end, where it's going to start syncing up with the events of 101 Dalmatians.
Yeah. Maybe a little.
A slight movie about dogs that watch TV. We went through all of this 2-hour and 15-minute movie where we were having Velvet Goldmine-like productions of I Want to Be Your Dog, which, oh my god, really?
If Iggy Pop were dead, he'd be rolling over in his grave.
I mean, Iggy Pop must have signed off on it level. Or actually, you don't have to ask the artist. You just
not necessarily.
Have to ask the label.
It depends on the rules, but it depends on how your contract works out. But
typically, you only have to ask the label if you're going to use something on a soundtrack. And if there was a big objection, Iggy Pop would have put up a stink. He probably didn't care.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great if Iggy Pop had shown up in this movie?
That would have been cool.
As the Baroness.
Yes! Oh my god,
Just Iggy Pop as the Baroness.
He's a pretty good actor, actually. He doesn't do it often, but whenever he acts, he's always...
He's okay.
Fine. He's old movie.
I like to see him and stuff.
Yeah.
He played a Vorta in Deep Space Nine.
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, he was on Deep Space Nine. Played one of the Founders.
I remember as being the
Founders were the changelings.
He was the absolute best part of the Crow's City of Angels. Like, he actually brought humanity into that film.
I have a recording of Iggy Pop reading The Telltale Heart.
Ooh,
it's really great.
That's cool.
True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous. I had been and am. It's just the coolest thing. Anyway, but after all of this gigantic rigmarole, this very long movie about missing lockets and lost lineage and all of these big stupid twists.
Yeah. Art is an aristocratic right.
That's a big theme of it. That's a shitty theme. That was a big part of the Beauty and the Beast remake, too. You're not just a smart person from a small town. You're actually from a big city, and your intelligence is like... This birthright.
Yeah, all of your finest qualities are a birthright. Thanks, Disney. That's a great message for everybody.
It lines up with, like, trying to set up the opening scenes of 101 Dalmatians, which, if you recall, was a guy sitting in an apartment writing songs with a dog sitting next to him. Like, there's nothing big and momentous about the events of 101 Dalmatians that all of this should lead to.
Yeah, and I'm going to throw it out there. Doesn't track. Like, without going into great details, like, if you're actually, like, thinking, oh, this is leading to 101 Dalmatians, then it makes no sense whatsoever. 101 Dalmatians couldn't possibly play out the way it does. I remember I interviewed the writer of Alice in Wonderland and Maleficent.
Okay.
And...
That is...
Linda Wolverton.
Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland.
Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. Right. And Richard Stromberg did Maleficent. Anyway... one of the things in Maleficent was, and this is in like the opening narration, which is, you've heard the story of Sleeping Beauty, but here's the version, here's what really happened. Here's the version you haven't heard. And I remember, asking Linda Wolverton, like, well, how did we hear the wrong version? Because at the end of the movie, everyone
kind of knows the true version.
Pretty much agrees on what actually happened. And it was basically just, we didn't really think about it. It's not really important to us.
A little meta moment. They're talking to the modern audience. You've seen The Sleeping Beauty.
But my point is this. It's you're thinking about everything, really. You're retroactively inserting plot that can pay off in another movie.
Yeah.
It's weird to me sometimes when they don't think that out. Like, Cruella might... I don't think it works as its own story. I don't think it's a good movie. But, like... If it did, it just couldn't possibly lead to 101 Dalmatians as we knew it.
Mm. It would have to lead to a different version of 101 Dalmatians.
And, like, I guess that's not inherently a horrible thing, but it's confusing to us because literally the only reason this movie exists is as a prelude to this previous film that is enormously successful that we know. So the fact that the actual connective tissue between Cruella and 101 Dalmatians, either the animated version or the live-action version or any version that we know, doesn't connect, track, it would be like if, like, we had, like, a prequel to Scream and it ended with, like, someone sending Neve Campbell, like, the Scream mask in the mail and her, like, getting the mail, like, oh, it's a Scream mask, and that's the ending. And you're like, what the fuck does that have to do with anything? That's what happens! What are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. I've noticed a big part, this is not fully the reason that Disney is sort of milking their old animated properties, but I mean they've always done it, so yeah. It's just the new version of it.
Yeah,
a lot of these remakes tend to exist to address not a problem with the story or a problem with the characters or some mystery that was left unsolved from the movies, but to address criticism of those films from the outside world that has come up in the interim.
Here's why this movie might not play as well today, because this is what we talk about.
So
yeah,
we're going to remake Aladdin, and we're going to cast a lot of non-white actors in an Arabian story. Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, it's the best part of the Lion King remake, is that the cast isn't a bunch of white people.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of white people in the cast of the original Lion King, and the movie takes place entirely in Africa. The original Lion King, the new Lion one, not so much.
Yeah, it's worse in something like Beauty and the Beast, where they're trying so hard to cover for all these criticisms of the 1991 film that the story loses all of its power.
Yeah,
they try to make the villains a little bit too sympathetic. Well, here's why they really act this way. Here's why Belle was really in this position. Mm-hmm. Here's a criticism that she is suffering from Stockholm syndrome. Well, we're gonna add a few more plot elements so it actually seems a little bit more natural. But in so doing, they're actually introducing new problems into the story about how all of these people in the castle are also to blame for this guy who's actually not so bad. So what are we actually saying in these new remakes? And I feel like what we're addressing here is something you said about Cruella de Vil, is that she actually seems like a character that has a lot of agency, but she's clearly her function is a villain.
Yeah.
And I would argue that if you're going to present a villain, it's okay for them to just be villainous.
Yeah.
We don't need sympathy for that character. In fact, they have a lot more dramatic power as forces of evil.
Yeah.
And they're a lot more interesting if we don't know their backstory.
Yeah. Now, you're Disney. You don't have to make them kill people. You know, you can pull back that far. But, like, if this had just been all about Eve in the fashion world in the 70s, and you just ignored all the other shit, and it was just about... Because here's the thing with Cruella de Vil. Near as I could tell, self-made person. Okay? She had talent, she had drive, she had personality, and she pushed her way to the top. And I can respect that. The way that they've concocted this weird legacy narrative for her really takes a lot of that away from her, actually. And I think that's bullshit. I think if you had just done, okay, here's how Cruella de Vil became the top fashion designer in the world. That's enough. I don't need all the bullshit with the Dalmatians. I don't need all the bullshit with the mystery of her mom and all this. I don't need that. It can just be about the fashion industry. That's interesting enough. That's a weird world. There's a lot of interesting characters that come out of that world. You can totally do that. Why do we need all this other stuff? Oh, and also, at the end of it, like, you could just, that if you just want to build up to it, she's, like, sitting on her throne. She's just taken over the fashion industry. And someone asks her reporter friend, like, whatever. It's like, okay, well, what are you going to do for your next line? I'm thinking,
Spots.
I think it's spots.
Spots is the new black. Yeah, whatever.
Done. And then, if you want to be cute, and I think it would work better than it does in the context of the movie, then you play I Want to Be Your Dog.
There you go.
Just over, like, the credits. So just as a setup.
Cute little joke at the end. It's like at the end of Jon Favreau's Iron Man.
Yeah.
Only at the end did they play Iron Man. I am Iron Man.
No, look, it's not my job to say how the movie should have been made, but when I'm spending a lot of time thinking about how this movie could be better, it's indicative of that the movie that I'm watching isn't working for me.
Yeah.
And a lot of things about this movie doesn't work. I think this movie desperately tries to coast on. It's not camp because it's intentional. It tries to coast on kitsch. It tries to coast
it's
on.
It's not even high kitsch. No. It's just sort of like a little drop of kitsch.
It's like Emma Stone is going to like overact a bit. Emma Thompson is going to be Emma Thompson, so she's fine. We don't need to worry about Emma Thompson. She'll do anything. she'll do anything. She was even good in Saving Mr. Banks, a wretched and evil film. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole.
Loathsome picture.
Yeah, but she's good in it, you know? Like, so she's a brilliant, brilliant actor. These are two brilliant actors. And honestly, the supporting cast is really good. Paul Walter Hauser is really good in this. Like, there's good people in this. Mm. But it seems like it's just trying to coast on retro kitsch. We're trying to like sell children 70s music. We're trying to sell children Cruella de Vil wigs, which I'm sure will be everywhere come Halloween. And it's just ultimately feels cynical and pointless when you really could have done something. You really could have done something that didn't feel this contrived. You could have just done a story about how Cruella de Vil became a big fashion designer. Mm. It did not need to be this contrived. Yeah.
For a movie that's set in London in the 70s in the fashion industry, they at least went the full mile with the costumes.
The costumes are cool.
The costumes are pretty cool looking. I did like her garbage gown.
It turns out that's actually, I hope they got permission from it, but it turns out that's actually a gown that was part of like a sculpture thing. If you look up like garbage, a long skirt gown or something like that, you can find it on Google. I forget who did it. But that was like someone did that like 10 years ago. Yeah. So I'm hoping they give them credit, at least a thank you in the credits for that. Because, it bugs me when they're practically taking credit for the whole punk movement. And I'm like, Disney, you don't get to do that.
It needed to be shorter. It needed to be messier. It needed to be gayer, quite frankly. I was getting like whiffs of Velvet Goldmine and they were too tantalizing. Like, well, now I just want to go watch Velvet Goldmine.
Yeah. There is a character that Disney has once again said, oh, it's our first openly gay character. Are we going to talk about that?
Nope.
It's
a pretty openly queer character, yes.
But there's it also not in dialogue, so they still have plausible deniability. Yeah, you could just if they want to just cut those scenes out. That character lifts out of the movie completely. You do not need that character on screen in order to tell the story.
Until they mention it in dialogue expressly and openly multiple times throughout the film.
Yeah, to the extent that you can't edit it out of the movie without.
I will give Disney no credit.
No.
Not.
It's very superficial attempt to gain credibility for doing the absolute least.
Look, representation. This character we made up and is very minor, and we don't ever explicitly mention their sexuality. Mm. Aren't we progressive?
Yeah. Why can't Cruella be queer?
Yeah, why
She's
not?
She's definitely got the vibes. Like,
In fact, when I was watching 101 Dalmatians, we were coming up with the backstory. Oh, it turns out that she and Anita were lovers in college.
I buy it.
Yeah, so no, nothing like that.
Yeah. It's not a good film.
Make
anyway.
A main character gay. I dare you.
Dare you.
I double dog dare you.
Ooh, that'd be a great name for Cruella 2. Cruella 2, double dog dare.
Give her a female lover.
Ooh.
Or get out of my face.
Oh, who plays her lover in the sequel?
Oh, gosh. Well, the actress who played Anita.
I feel like they want to like go with the original story route there.
She's kind of played this role before, but why not Gugu Mbatha-Raw? I love her in everything.
I was thinking Betty Gilpin. She's great. She was so fucking funny in The Hunt. She'd have been a great Cruella, actually. Anyway, moving on. We got to move on. We still have quite a few movies to review. Do you want to talk about... I'll let you go next. Want to talk about... Plan B or Swimming Out Till the Sea Turns Blue?
I'm going to be very brief on Swimming Out Till the Sea Turns Blue.
Okay,
this is the latest documentary film from a Chinese director named Jia Zhengke. And Jia Zhengke does documentaries and fictional features. And this is my first of their films. And I say I'm going to be brief on this because, unfortunately, I'm not... knowledgeable enough about contemporary Chinese literature to comment with any kind of cogency about this film.
Okay.
This is a documentary it focuses on four well-known Chinese authors, and three of them are alive, and he gets them on camera. The three authors are Jia Pinghua, Yu Hua, and Liang Hong. And I have read none of their work, and I'm not familiar with their work. And this film isn't a celebration of these authors, and it's not taking us through their timeline and establishing what they did to become famous. It's just sort of accepted that these are well-known authors and that we should be familiar with their work. And they are talking about not their writing, but their growing up in a province, in the same province in China.
Okay.
And we talk to them and they tell stories about how they grew up and what was going on politically in China when they were younger and how they would mill grain. And we talk to, you know, siblings and family members. One of them has a teenage son who's like, oh, well, I guess, you know, this is my experience with, you know, my famous relative. And if I were more familiar with these authors, then I could speak a little bit more eloquently as to how their experience relates to the Chinese national character or mm-hmm. the Chinese literary scene at large.
Mm-hmm. Or at least their own work.
Something about their work. But this is clearly a film made for a Chinese audience.
Okay.
It's made for people who know a lot more about Chinese history, this particular Chinese province, these authors, and what they wrote about and how they reflect on all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
What I can get in the abstract from a film like this is how singular authors or singular works, great works of literature, can indeed leave sort of these ripples throughout history and throughout society, and how they do tend to alter culture, how these things are changing culture in these very subtle ways throughout. But the specifics eluded me, and that was really frustrating. And that has nothing to do with the filmmaking. That just has to do with, I will openly say it, my own ignorance.
Yeah.
I don't know. So what I'm going to say, instead of giving this film sort of a glowing review or a damnation, I'm going to implore that our listeners, if we have any Chinese listeners or listeners who are interested in or know a lot about contemporary Chinese literature, if they know about any of these authors, to write in and tell me.
Especially if you see the film, that'd be great.
If you've seen the film, write in, tell me what you know about these authors, what they mean to you, what they mean to China at large, if you know, or what your impression of them was, or even if you just read their book and thought it was okay.
Yeah.
I would love to hear something, but this film is unfortunately not giving me any of that. And because I'm so ignorant, it feels opaque, even though it isn't.
It's actually kind of unusual that a film that is so steeped in something very specific offers no invitation to people who aren't already familiar with it to get a significant release. In America sometimes. Like, it's oftentimes, like, the stuff that ends up in America is the stuff that they feel is most accessible to mainstream Americans. So this is actually kind of interesting that you got to take this incredible, like, dive into the deep end.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad for it. And, you know, now that I have the experience watching this movie, I'm probably going to recognize some things. They do quote some of their works throughout this movie. An interesting narrative device is they would have an actor come on the screen, read a passage from one of the novels, and then we'd get to see it in text on the screen, that same passage in text on the screen. So we can kind of have a contemporary reading of it as well as just the raw language. I like that. That was really great. And the film ends with the teenage son just sort of trying to understanding that he needs to maybe connect with history and his own family and sort of the artistic legacy of the country a little bit more strongly.
Yeah,
please tell me, please write in. because it's rare that I feel this much at a loss, like this much of an outsider when I'm coming into a movie. And again, that's nothing to say of what's going on in this film, which is pretty expertly crafted
right. In
terms of what is going through. It's caught up into like 18 chapters. They all have different sort of themes about what the conversations are going to be. Some of them are pretty long. Some is like maybe just a couple of minutes. So I was able to follow who everybody was and what they were talking about, but I needed a little bit more historical context to understand the significance of what I was saying.
That's interesting because I'll just make a detour now into the documentary I saw this week, which is called Moby Doc, which is about Moby. It's the story of Moby, and Moby narrates it.
That is the musician.
Musician. Yeah, not the whale. And it's about his rise to fame. And it is about how fame and success and popularity have brought him no inner peace, which is interesting until you realize that that's a lot of this. Moby, if you're not super familiar with him, is he's mostly known for dance music. He's also dabbled in punk. He's worked with a lot of people, Gwen Stefani, David Bowie. His album Play from 1999
was
huge. And in large part because every single track on that album was either released as a single or like licensed to a major movie or a commercial or something. Like it was just ubiquitous.
Danny Boyle's movie The Beach
used
a Moby song called Porcelain. Which that was my entrance into Moby.
I can't remember what my entrance was in the Moby. I think I heard some of his early stuff, actually. I think he did like this dance remix version of the Twin Peaks theme, which ended up catching the attention. It caught some attention, and it ended up catching the attention of David Lynch, who appears in this documentary as someone who is talking about the greatness of Moby. And there's a bit where they talk about how Moby spent some time when he was young squatting basically in a factory. It had free electricity, no running water or anything, and he just stayed there and made music. And there's this bit where he's talking to David Lynch and they're just talking about how they think old factories are cool, and David Lynch is like, yeah, old factories are amazing, you're the best, Moby. And I'm watching this and going, Moby Doc is, if you're interested in Moby's music, not uninteresting. Like, it's certainly made with that interesting sort of remix methodology that he applies to a lot of his movies. There's a lot of interesting juxtapositions of image and music and sound and tone and home video footage and new interview footage and sort of do-it-yourself recreations of stuff he has no footage for. Like, there's a bit where he asks his friends play the roles of his parents so that he can like relive some scenes from his childhood. And there's this bit where
it's incredibly self-serving.
He does have a sense of humor about it, though. There's a bit where like his mom and his mom's like new boyfriend are like leaving him in a motel room. It's like, hey, we're gonna go get drunk, we'll see you later. And then Moby's like, okay, that was good, but you're way too interested in Moby. Like, you care way too much about how he feels about you leaving. Like, scale it back. Like, he clearly is working through some shit. And he's very frank about a lot of his struggles with addiction. His time where he came very close to killing himself, but he couldn't get a window open. So he ended up not doing it. And I'll applaud him for being that frank about that stuff. There's also stuff that he doesn't talk about. Like, one of the more notorious things about Moby in the recent years was he wrote an autobiography or something. And in it, he talked about dating Natalie Portman, which Natalie Portman said they never did. And then Moby insisted. And then Natalie Portman was like, no, we never dated. And that was weird. I appreciate that Moby is very frank here about how fame is weird. It turns you into someone weird. And he talks about how he, even though he was giving interviews talking about how, you know, fame is not what I'm all about, he also talks about, I loved being famous. It was so cool. I lived next to Bowie and we were friends. Like, that kind of shit. And I can appreciate that. And I think that's kind of interesting to see someone who is willing to admit just how much of an alien being rich and famous can make you, and to have everyone telling you your work is brilliant you. bless you. But there is an unmistakable air of egocentrism here. And not just because... Moby didn't direct this, but it's clear he was very important, like, creative force behind it. He's like in every scene. He's like, it's not like someone is making some candid Moby thing and they got one interview with Moby. Like, no, Moby is all over this thing. Like one of the concluding scenes is Moby talking to death, like with the scythe and the cloak and everything. Like, it's like,
oh my god.
Yeah,
look, when you're gonna have a show about Emily Dickinson talking to death,
You can kind of get away with that.
And she gets into a coach, and Death is played by, I think it was Wiz Khalifa.
Nice.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. No, this is
when,
Moby.
When you're doing it yourself.
Yeah. This is Moby working through some shit, and I can respect that. But it feels like you're reading an autobiography of a celebrity who's been a celebrity so long that they don't realize how weird their autobiography is, and they see all of this poetry and something everyone else is looking at and going, the fuck? It's kind of fascinating. It's, you know, I don't want to call it like a train wreck, but it is like watching someone do something they probably shouldn't be doing. Like, they certainly are too close to this material, I think. And that's kind of just interesting to see them just go for it. Like, there was something undeniably fascinating about seeing someone just really gaze at a navel. Like, just look at that navel. Wow! And that's kind of... And I actually like Moby's music. There's some good performances of his music in this movie. There's a couple... It's not a concert film, but there's a few. And they're good. Yeah, it's a weird fucking film. And it's at the point where good or bad is kind of irrelevant. It's not about being good or bad. It's about Moby trying to convey this sense of who he is and this idea that the personal journey that he's went on has not just depth to him, but some kind of weird cosmic importance. And that's something that I can't help but sort of innately reject. There's something that just feels false about that. Maybe not false. False might be the wrong word. But weirdly aggrandizing. And after a while, I didn't want to hang out with Moby. Is basically what it boiled down to. It seems like it wouldn't be fun to hang out with Moby that long. And I don't know if that's exactly what you're getting at with your documentary. Unless you're like really going like, Moby was like saying like, here's why I'm terrible. Like, that would be sad for Moby, actually. But like, I guess I'm glad his ego is going strong. I struggle with ego issues, so, like, cool, I guess. That must be nice. But, like, yeah. It's a weird fucking film. It's a weird fucking film. It's full of weird stylistic exercises. If you like Moby, it might be worth watching just so you get a better sense of, like, how he thinks about himself and his music and his career. But if you don't like Moby, listen to Play. Just listen to Play. It's a very commercial but very good album, and and he's done some other good stuff too. And that's it, basically.
I won't impugn Play.
It's overplayed. No one could argue. Is that the one where the Jason Bourne theme comes from? Is that
I don't remember.
It probably was. Anyway, but that's Moby Duck. And then we got two more films to talk about. Tell me about Plan B.
Plan B is the third film within a year about two teenage girls who have to go on a very long road trip in order to have access to either an abortion or birth control.
Right.
The first one was rare. I guess the first one might have been Unpregnant, which was on HBO Max last year.
They came out around the same time. That one and Never Rarely, Sometimes Always.
Never Rarely, Sometimes Always.
They came out within like a month or two of each other.
Yeah, those two were really close. And both of those films were about going on a road trip to get an abortion. Teenage girls going, in a pair of teenage girls specifically, going on the road to get an abortion. Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, is a much more kind of harrowing, realistic look at that and what it looks like and how difficult it is. There's a lot more natural scenes of just sort of spending time with the two leads and watching their friendship grow and change and alter through scenes where they're just sort of hanging out together. Unpregnant is like a madcap comedy where they're, you know, driving through barns and a lot of screaming. And one of them is queer, so there's a big coming out scene, only I like the way they kind of undercut the coming out in that movie. Plan B is another Unpregnant. It is almost identical to Unpregnant.
Weird.
So I guess all we really are going to have to go on is... Well, before I get to the movie itself, I think this is indicative of a trend where we're using cinema, and in two cases, cinematic comedy, to very directly address how shitty the abortion situation is in this country.
Yeah, it's a constitutional right. Like, the Supreme Court decided this many decades ago. And these are films that are specifically designed to explore and reveal to people who, especially if you didn't already know, just how much red tape, just how much bureaucracy, just how many people are trying to stand in the way of allowing people to have that right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these are inherently political films, like deeply political films.
So, yeah, this is a comedy film about two young girls played by wonderfully charming young actresses. And the success of these movies is going to depend entirely on the charm and the chemistry between the actresses. Kuho Verma plays the lead, and Victoria Morales plays her best friend. They are kind of the outsiders at their school. Victoria Morales' character is sort of like the punk rocker that not a lot of people talk to, and Kuho Verma plays sort of like the star nerd student, and nobody really talks to them. They throw a big party. Kuho Verma thinks that like her crush is going to be there, and she's finally going to be able to maybe have some sort of sexual contact with this guy. She's really eager for it, but she in a twist of fate, she sees him leaving the party with somebody else. She decides to make a very bad decision and has an incredibly bad sexual encounter with another guy. Wakes up in the morning, realizes that there had been a mishap with the condom, and now she needs to get a Plan B pill. And the pharmacy will refuse it to her. The guy who runs the pharmacy is Jay Trondasekhar from Broken Lizard.
Oh, that's cool.
He's always a delight. I love that guy. So they decide they have to go to the nearest Planned Parenthood clinic, and that, of course, is hours away by car. So they have to go on a wacky road trip, and mishaps ensue. They begin to re-examine the nature of their friendship. Whose fault is this, really? I'm also reminded a lot of Booksmart in their relationship, about how they're sort of goody-goodies who are contesting with the fact that they've made what they feel is an incredibly bad decision and have to come to terms with the fact that actually this is just life sometimes. And of course, one of them is queer.
Okay.
That seems to be another element that's a big part of this subgenre. It's perfectly charming.
Okay.
Both of the leads are great. I loved Kuho Verma. She's a star waiting to happen. She's just going to find the right project at some point. And Victoria Morales brings a lot of, at first she seems like sort of like the comic foil, but over the course of the film, she's actually given a lot more emotional depth and her own emotional journey to go on. This film was directed by Natalie Morales, who I've seen in... You've probably seen her on shows like The Grinder. She's had a lot of supporting roles in bigger films like the Wall Street sequel. This is her first film as a director, and she handles it... She avails herself quite well. Unlike Unpregnant, which is really kind of madcap and a little bit unfocused, this one is actually incredibly tight. It's really, really well put together, which for such a... a story which is now becoming increasingly familiar is really, really important. So if you're going to do something that's actually a little bit, I hate to say contrived because it's so new, but something that has been done before, it's best to have something that actually glues it together really, really well. And I think Natalie Morales does it perfectly.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah, it's good.
It's not that it matters, but like on like the if you look at these three films as like part of a subgenre, is there one that's clearly better than the others?
Never, rarely, sometimes, always is the best of these, just because it actually bothers to confront sort of the drama of the situation, a lot of the realism of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And also that film is very much about the way young women are treated and objectified and sexualized in a lot of really like myriad subtle ways that add into this big like freight train of mistreatment. There's a scene in Never Really Sometimes Always where the two leads work retail. One of them is handing cash to her manager, and her manager like grabs her hand, like touches her hand when she's handing him money, and that just that like tiny little moment seems like such a violation.
Yeah.
It's like this really uncomfortable moment for her, and she understands what's going on immediately, and she kind of recoils in disgust, but she can't call him out because it's such a small moment and she's young and he's the boss that she's additionally put in this really awkward situation. There aren't deep moments like that in something like Plan B. Plan B is a little bit more broad. It's a little bit more widely written. It's not examining anything much deeper than what I already said about sort of examining how shitty the politics are about birth control and women's sexuality and the control of women's bodies in this country, which of course should be addressed.
Yeah.
There are also two minorities living in ultra Christian South Dakota. So they're also there's also a racial dimension to this where they are recognized for their race, but thankfully never fall to stereotype. There's like fun things that are very personal to them, but feel very universal as well.
Okay.
Yeah. I liked Plan B. It's not, you know, gonna knock anything over, but I do find it interesting that we're getting more and more of these kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to see if we're going to keep on going. Three films denotes a trend.
Agreed.
This was a little miniature trend. You can even put Booksmart in if you want four. So where is this trend going to go? This entire new subgenre about pairs of teenage girls seeking sexual health.
Well, and again, the goal of something like this, I would hope, would be to raise awareness. And again, these are stories that are catering to, or like their target demographic is younger people. And they're going to see this experience dramatized. When you see it over and over again, it just hammers home the fact that this is not a unique occurrence.
Yeah.
This is not something that happens once. This is something that is a problem throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, hopefully that actually has an impact. That's really interesting. I'm sorry I missed it.
Yeah, it's on Hulu. You can watch it if you have Hulu.
Instead, I watched Skull, The Mask.
Isn't this a sequel to Skull?
No, it's a sequel to The Mask.
We had one. It was called Son of the Mask.
No, actually, it actually has some of the same mechanics as the movie The Mask, but it's got nothing to do with any of that. It's actually, this is a Brazilian film, and it is short for, the original title was Skull, and I hope I'm pronouncing the name of this, because it's the name of a old South American deity, but it was Skull, The Mask of Anyanga.
Okay.
And so, rather than say, call it in America, Skull, The Mask of Anyanga, they decided to just call it Skull, The Mask.
Skull, The Mask.
Which is not a great title. I'm just going to throw that out there. I know that's not the end-all be-all of the film, but I'm just going to say right now, the title is just weird.
The Mask of Anyanga is a better title.
Agreed. But anyway, it stands out, you know? But I'm actually rather fond of this film. It is a supernatural slasher of sorts. It opens like around World War, I forget the exact year. I think it's around World War II in South America, where there's some like wild wrestler assassin who kills a bunch of people and steals an ancient skull. And then they like sacrifice someone to this skull. And then the skull rattles around a bit and something really terrible is going to happen. And then it cuts to the present day. And the skull has been found in the middle of, like, a rainforest.
Okay.
And so a big corporation has enlisted someone to bring the skull back to them. But then they take it back home, and it turns out that this woman's girlfriend is possibly involved in a cult dedicated to this deity. And so as soon as the woman's in bed, her girlfriend, like, puts like candles in a circle and chants the magic words over it, and the skull comes to life and it pops like spider legs out of its head and starts crawling around, and then it attaches to people's heads, and when they're inside,
that sounds fun.
And when they're inside its head, then you see inside this weird red and black but kaleidoscopic universe filled with like skeletons that scream at you and shit. And I'm watching this and I'm like, this is awesome. I have no idea what's going on, but this is awesome. And then that woman dies, and everyone dies. It's all death. And then a cop is brought on board to investigate this bizarre ritualistic slaying, and I love, I'm sure this is just a translation issue, but I love the translation of this because it's so evocative, where she's not just like a heroic cop. She's actually like a controversial cop. Maybe she shouldn't be on the force because she was previously indicated in what the press call slaughter crimes, which is a hell of a crime.
New career.
Slaughter crimes. Just slaughter crimes. What's called slaughter crimes?
It's a great title. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're dealing with this possibly corrupt cop, and she's investigating this weird murder, and then the skull ends up latching itself onto one of the guys who's responsible for cleaning up the crime scene after everything's been done and investigated. Mm. And now this guy has this big-ass skull on his head, and he goes on a fucking murder spree where he's like choking people with their own intestines and like then taking the intestines and attaching it to a knife so he can use it as a projectile weapon that he can like sling back to him. And this is
by the time you've gotten the intestines out, the job's done. All right.
Yeah,
need to take that extra step.
No, we're still doing it. The skull has been dormant for decades. It's got ideas and it needs to implement them.
It's that shot in Suspiria where the killer's stabbing through his victim's chest and
carving
a big open hole
through the chest to see the heart.
And then after all of that effort, stabs the heart.
Yeah.
I would think all that first part would have gotten the job done.
It's
symbolic.
It's like signing your work, you know? It's about the art of the death, you know? And I think that's true, actually. I'm joking about it, but for a lot of horror movies, you know, horror movies depict death more frankly than most other genres typically do.
Yes.
And more often, certainly. And there comes this point where you're portraying death so much in a genre that it becomes necessary to spice it up a little bit. You know, like I've seen this scene so many times. I can't just see someone like just stabbed in the back and going, and then falling over. It's a little rote now. Mm. So as a filmmaker, horror filmmakers like to see what they can do, like see what they come up with. And sometimes it's fun. If the tone of the movie is fun and it's just like, I can't believe, let's see how gory and crazy this movie's going to get. This is like, there's a real movie. And then at the other end of, like, you know, the form, the, what am I calling here? Like the other end of the
spectrum?
Spectrum. Oh, yeah. At the other end of the spectrum, there's a trauma movie.
Okay.
Now, if you know what trauma is, trauma is a very low budget studio that has produced films like The Toxic Avenger and Sergeant Kabuki Man and YPD. And they'll also notoriously pick up any extremely low budget genre film, provided it has sex, violence, or both. A lot of the trauma movies, whether they're made by trauma or released by trauma, barely movies. Like, they're just there to deliver that weird outre content. And sometimes that's wonderful. So there are some good movies that have been released by trauma.
They
serve their function. You know what you're going to get. As soon as you see the trauma logo, you know what you're going to get. And you're either with it or you're not. But trauma is extremely low budget. There's a handful of trauma movies that are legitimately very good. Tromeo and Juliet is one of them. But most of them are really, really on the low end of feature filmmaking in terms of budget and class and style. And then somewhere over here, there's like a real movie. And like and I don't mean that term derogatorily. I just mean like what you usually expect from a motion picture in terms of budget and look and class and ambition. And Skull the Mask is like two-thirds of the way, either one way or the other on that list. Like, it's got all of the gore and craziness and frankly really baffling plotting that you would want from a movie that is only trying to titillate you and show you like the weirdest, grossest kills you can find.
Okay.
But it also is trying to be a real movie, and there are some elements of it that work better than others. There's a great commentary here about how corporations are coming into countries and they are basically strip mining their culture for their own personal gain.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that in this movie. It's very literalized. That part's fine. It's also about police corruption, and it also gives no fucking shits about it, like, at all. Like, it doesn't really deal with... We find out that this woman is very guilty of slaughter crimes. like very guilty of slaughter crimes, but we're with her anyway because we have no one else except, of course, for this like small cadre of like priests who have been preparing for the return of these like elder gods, and they know martial arts and shit, and that is less a part of the movie than you might think, but when it is there, it is cool. I like it when people see Dead Alive, when the thing that they take away from it isn't just the gore, it's the I kick ass for the Lord scene. So again, this movie, it's like plot wise it's thin and it's frankly a little confusing. But as a delivery system for imaginative gore and some interesting visuals, and a reasonably like cool, like just like what if the mask, but evil, like evil mythology, I had a good time with it. So this is currently a Shudder exclusive, and you can watch it on Shudder. And if anything I just talked about sounds like your bag, don't miss it. And if what I sounded like sounds like nails on chalkboard to you, yeah, watch something else. why wouldn't you? Like, it sounds like this is not your film. But, like, there's a very specific audience for this. And I think that there is this weird... I found this thing where I'm, like, I'm looking up, like, weird old horror movies on, like, Tubi or whatever. At our local video store, Cinephile. And I'll see a title... And I'll look at a premise, and it seems really interesting. And if I see that the movie was made in, like, the 70s or the 80s, or maybe the early 90s, I get really excited. Because there's probably been some effort put into it. But if I see it was made in the 2010s and I hadn't heard of it, there's a decent chance it's just made completely with no ambition whatsoever and just thrown out there in the straight-to-video market. And that's not unilaterally true, but just the odds are in its favor.
And a lot of this has to do with the technology, you know, digital photography versus film technology, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've encountered the exact same thing. And on Friday nights, my wife and I have been sort of marathoning through just whatever schlock we can find. I recently saw films like Hawk the Slayer for the first time. We watched Blackenstein the other night. Just like old exploitation movies.
Yeah.
And we kind of have a cutoff. If it's like early 90s, we're okay. But by the time we're into, like, the mid-2000s, we don't care.
If it was shot on digital video, there's a really decent chance it's not going to be worth it. And that's, again, not unilaterally true, but really decent chance. Because you had to really try to make, like a low-budget schlocky movie back when you had 35mm.
By the late 90s, too much of the public had access to irony, and it was difficult to earnestly make a schlocky kind of movie anymore.
Yeah.
And so whenever you come up upon a new schlocky movie, there's always like a little bit too much of a wink.
Yes.
In the case of something like Sharknado, it's nothing but winking.
Agreed. But
so yeah, if you can find just a good, legit new exploitation movie, then I'm going to be all about it.
That's what I'm all about. Where I'm basically saying like there was this period where you would get movies like this, but they would just have a little bit more panache and a little bit more sincerity, and you would see films, and some of them were funny, but like you would see films like The Evil Dead or Reanimator or Dead Alive and or Bad Taste, and these were films that were made by people who were really passionate about it and just really loved what they were doing. And this is pretty close to that. I'm not going to say it's an instant classic like a lot of those movies were, but like it's pretty close to that. And if you're starving for that kind of movie and you wish there were more movies like that today, Skull the Mask will get you there. Skull the Mask is worth taking a hit off of. So, and I'm part of that audience. So on the critically acclaimed scale, where we review films on a scale of C- to C+, C is average, some good, some bad. C- is below average. We simply don't recommend it. Or maybe the worst film ever made. And C+ is above average. We genuinely recommend it. Possibly it's the best film ever made. Anywhere in the middle is fine. On the critically acclaimed scale, I'm going to give Skull the Mask a mild C+.
Okay.
It's definitely for a particular audience, but I'm in that audience, and I had a good time. It's very wild, and I'll say something like this. I was never bored. And that's something that, for this kind of movie, is a really good recommendation. Was never bored, and I had a good time. So, Skull the Mask, C+. What else we got here? Plan B.
Plan B, a high C.
Okay.
It does everything it needs to do, and it does it well. But it's not revolutionary. It's not, you know, reinventing the wheel.
Moby Doc, I'm also giving a C. It's not like he's got his head, you know, off in the clouds somewhere and it's like completely not worth seeing. Like, it's actually kind of interesting to see like what his perspective is on himself. I'm just not sure it's particularly valuable to anybody other than fame doesn't bring you happiness, man, which is, yeah, okay. I'm just not
can
sure
I,
it was
can
worth
I try.
I'm not, yeah, like I'm not sure it was necessarily worth the whole movie to get you there, but if you're a fan of Moby, it's definitely a must-see, would be elevated to a C+. But for everyone else, it's just kind of an interesting it's a self-centered exercise, but it's not necessarily a self-centered exercise that is hard to watch or isn't necessarily interesting. I think it is interesting. I just don't know if it's good. I think it's a little too full of itself to be good. Let's see. Swimming out till the sea turns blue.
Swimming out till the sea turns blue.
Bit of a long title.
I'll give it a C, but like I said, I want input. I need study.
Yeah.
I need to be learned.
Yeah.
So learn me.
Okay. And please email us. letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is the email address if you have particular knowledge of the subject matter of Swimming Out Till the Sea Turns Blue, and particularly if you've seen the film itself. We would love to hear from you and be able to give that film the context it really needs in order to have a real review. So it's an interesting experience. I didn't see it, but it sounds like it was interesting for Whitney. Cruella.
That's a C-.
It's a C-.
It's too long. It's bloated. Yeah. It's punk cred does not land.
All of its most interesting parts are really superficial, and I don't think they're going to age well. I think it's going to be like once you know the music, and once you know what the outfits look like, there's just not a lot to this one, and I think it whiffs almost everything it tries. I think thematically it's weak. I think it's a prequel to The 101 Dalmatians. It's weak. I think it's a re-envisioning of Cruella DeVille. I think it's so reliant on the previous films that it doesn't really give her the freedom to be re-envisioned truly. As a delivery system for Emma Thompson, great, but we have no shortage of those. Same thing with Emma Stone. Like, I'd much rather just watch The Favorite again, thank you. Like, it just feels like it's...
Yeah, if you want sumptuous outfits and a rivalry with royal Brits, then go to The Favorite instead. Yeah,
please see The Favorite. It's amazing. It's a really good movie. And then lastly, I didn't see it, A Quiet Place Part 2.
Also, I see.
Okay.
Yeah, decent, funny, scary.
Cool.
Millicent Simmons is great.
Nice.
Monsters have big claws.
They do.
So I give it a C. Put that on your poster. Quiet Place Part 2. Monsters have big claws.
Well, it's true, damn it. We can prove that one. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Very special shout out to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, without whom this show and any of our other shows wouldn't be possible. We want to remind everybody, if you're a fan of the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, to tune in tomorrow. Because tomorrow we'll be debuting the first proper individual episode of the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club with our double feature of Troop Beverly Hills. Why do I keep saying Beverly Hills Troop? I've seen Troop Beverly Hills like 50 times.
All of the films with Beverly Hills in the title that aren't The Taking of Beverly Hills, the Beverly Hills part comes first.
You're right. That's probably why I'm doing it. But it's still weird. Like, I have a framed Troop Beverly Hills poster in my apartment. That's true. Whitney, confirm this.
I don't know what he's talking about.
Shut up.
He does. He has one.
I do. We love that movie in this household, so it's weird that I got that wrong. But anyway, it's Troop Beverly Hills and a gnome named Gnorm. We'll be talking about that on the next one of those. We also have a lot of other shows here at our network. Please subscribe if you haven't already. And seriously, our Patreon is just... We're incredibly grateful to everybody, and we hope you enjoy the litany of podcasts that we're releasing. This podcast is going live on Memorial Day, which is also a day in which we're releasing five episodes at once of our Star Trek podcast, All Our Yesterdays. It's a holiday marathon for Star Trek, and we're doing 5 episodes of Star Trek, the animated series. We're doing 1 episode per episode of Star Trek ever, and yeah, big marathon. So we hope you enjoy them. And, okay. And, of course, you can always email us letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is the email address. letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. You want to talk to us about something we discussed in this episode. You want to ask us questions, take us to task for anything. That's the way to do it. We might read your email in upcoming We've Got Mail. We're also on Twitter @criticacclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
If you want soap, head on over to Etsy. Look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. Soulcatsoap is also our Twitter and Instagram account. May 31st is the last day of our 10% off sale on select items. And then we're actually going away for a couple of days, so the store will close down temporarily until we get back on the first Saturday of June and release a lot of cool new products, including a jar of bisexual chaos, which is...
That's soap. That's not me. That's,
yeah. It's, we have like a lot of offerings for Pride Month, and one of them is called Bisexual Chaos, and it is a really nice-smelling... set of soap that looks like the bisexual flag.
I'm going to hold the soap up to the mic, see if you can smell it.
Get a whiff.
Is it good? Yeah, see, it smells good.
Nice, right? It's a really fascinating treat in soap form. I hope you enjoy that. And I also have a design of my own that will be going live on the first Saturday of June. So,
hooray!
In addition to a bunch of other cool things. So please check us out, and we'll tell you more about it later. And that is that for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you everybody for listening, and never forget, everyone's a critic.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?